Good evening and welcome to the forum. On tonight's program, we present KU professor William Lindsay on the new rituals of death and dying in contemporary Japan. This talk was recorded at the Lawrence Unitarian Fellowship on May 22nd. Enjoy.
This is not my specialty of research, but I do think it's interesting. I thought it would be, you know, actually, I don't know if fun is the right word, but it's really what we're going to talk about is really not depressing at all. It's very life-affirming in many ways, and it's kind of a pulse on contemporary Japan and some of the rituals, new rituals that are in the process of being created in Japan in dealing with the rise of the elderly in Japan. This is one of the most recent charts of demographics of age demographics in Japan. I think this is from 2015, just a year ago. So 13% of the population, that very narrow green slice right there, those are children, 14 years and younger. The large 61% there in blue is 15 years of age to 64 years of age. And then that more than a quarter right there in red, 26%, that is 65 years and older. And just I'm not an expert on demographics at all, but I think it was just 4 or 5 years ago that was more at like 22 or 23%. So it's going up very rapidly. Also, I think maybe it was like a year or 2 years ago that Japan hit that point where more people were dying than babies being born. And so the population is in decline right now. But I do want to talk about how in this situation, from a ritual perspective, what we can understand about aging and ritual in the contemporary scene in Japan. So we'll look at pre-funerals. That is a new ritual. That's something that's been going on for maybe 25 years. It has some controversy to it. It does make a number of Japanese uncomfortable. And also sudden death temples. Sudden death temples are not necessarily new, but beginning maybe 30, 35 years ago, as it was clear that the population was aging, there started to be an explosion of them. So that's what we'll concentrate on today. So we'll talk about pre-funerals first. A pre-funeral, literally in Japanese, means something like a while-alive funeral or an in-life funeral. And we call them pre-funerals in English everywhere in the world, and certainly in Japan in the old days, to become old was a rather rare thing, and become very old was quite rare. Aging was considered, because it was relatively rare, it was considered a time of celebration. And so, but with more and more people becoming old, also because Japan has one of the best health delivery systems in the world, that's one reason why they live a long time. Healthcare is extremely affordable, easily accessible. Japanese are constantly going to the hospitals and doctors for what's, you know, seemingly the most minor of things. And I think that plays a very big role in why they live so long, is just great healthcare. But the aging of Japan has really caused kind of a shift in the perception of cultural significance. So while in the older days it was considered very culturally significant to become old, and it was very much a celebratory stage of life that relatively few achieved, now it's destiny for most. And so to become old is just not that big of a thing anymore. And that does have some... that does have some consequences to how it's viewed. It's not such a celebration anymore. It is just, well, that's what happens to most of us. And what was once charged with a special blessing for a lucky few to experience, which played into the need to mark it with rituals and things like that, now is just simply a statistical likely reality that most people are going to achieve. And I do want to say this, just as an overview, as some of you may very well know, Japan is a ritually dense culture. You do not make a transition in life, whether a significant transition or a minor transition, without marking it in some shape, way or form through ritual. Obviously, yes, weddings and funerals and things like that, but a new job, just being transferred within a company, these would be marked, you know, if you're going to be transferred in a company, at the very least, you will be taken out and, you know, you'll be, there will be a celebration. So Japan is a very ritually dense culture and no transition. great or small, is passed over. It's always, always recognized. And but in any sort of ritually dense culture, you do have then the possibility for new rituals. And that's what these pre-funerals are. As people live longer, they want to have more of a stake in the funeral. And that is what we will see here. So a pre-funeral is a funeral service that a person helps design while he or she is still alive. And so, and it does have the certain cultural marks of a funeral, but it's something where the not yet dead, the pre-dead, can celebrate his or her life in a manner that that person thinks is fitting. Interestingly, though, within the ritual idiom of a funeral. And the more, and like I, we will talk a little bit that pre-funerals can be somewhat controversial. They do make some people uncomfortable. I was talking to my my long-term partner in Japan. She joined me to visit my family in Maine, and we had a good time, but I was telling her about that. I'm going to give a small talk on pre-funerals, and what does she think of a pre-funeral, and what does she think a lot many Japanese think of a pre-funeral. And she was saying that it's odd and it's strange, that it's a waste of time, a waste of resources. That's how she felt about it, and that's how a lot of Japanese feel about it. But it's still out there as a new ritual, and new rituals can be controversial. They can kind of upturn the apple cart. But in Japan, as again, some of you may know, hotels are a major venue for important rituals. The wedding rituals, for example, so many weddings are held in hotels. Hotels will have spaces marked that are, they'll have a room that looks like a church or a room that looks like a Shinto shrine. And depending if you want a Christian style wedding, which many Japanese opt for, even though only about 1% of the population is Christian, or if you want a traditional Shinto wedding, which really isn't traditional at all. The first wedding ceremonies, modern wedding ceremonies, were Christian ceremonies, and there was no such thing as a Shinto ceremony. Shinto ceremonies came after Christian ceremonies were introduced in the early 20th century. But hotels are always important venues, and hotels are always out there with their feelers trying to get a sense of what is some new ritual ground that we can that we can build our profits on. And even though pre-funerals can be controversial in a while, and especially as the population ages even more, but certainly hotels can kind of give it a certain normalized aspect to it. So this is a hotel that is advertising itself as a venue for a pre-funeral. And it's stressing how the pre-funeral allows one to give thanks in one's own way to the ties and relations with other people in life as a way to prepare for one's own death. And that part of in one's own way, that becomes very important, the sense of a sense of this is me, this is my life, it will be my death. This is my moment to shine as I get older, and I want to mark it in my own way, things that I have to say, and people I want to thank. Pre-funerals, we can call them an emergent ritual. They're both steeped in older ritual forms of funerals, and yet they're also a critical of the funerals, especially the funeral industry. Oftentimes, many new rituals are an implied criticism of older rituals. But they are usually celebrated on or around the traditional celebratory markings of old age. So and Japanese never used to recognize birthdays. Recognizing a birthday every year is more or less a post-World War II American thing. And the oldest generation in Japan would still rarely mark a birthday year by year. But traditionally, these ages would be marked. These would be seen as significant transitions, again, because traditionally very few people hit them, especially the later. So 60, 77, 88, and 99. But especially 60 and 77, you're gambling if you're waiting to the age of 88 or 99 necessarily. So they do borrow that from the traditional culture. And they borrow from the material and rhetorical motifs of funerals. Flowers, large photograph, in your typical Japanese funeral, be it a Christian funeral or a Buddhist funeral, and most all funerals would be Buddhist funerals, there's always a large photograph of the person, along with just a wall of flowers and things such as that. And speeches are made. But it does act as ritual criticism of the funeral industry. For some people, all they want is their pre-funeral, and then when they die, they don't want anything else. Be cremated like everyone else is, and then have their ashes spread, or something like that. The funeral industry in Japan, like the funeral industry here, you know, we deal with it. No one likes it, though. They take advantage of people for reasons of profit when people are most emotionally vulnerable. It's kind of sometimes one size fits all. Things like that, and so the pre-funeral is very much an implied criticism of the funeral industry. It does assert individual choice and self-orientation. That's the important thing here, in many ways, for these older people in a culture that puts so much stress, you know, on the group and group cohesion. This is a time when the person can actually pull away from the group and really say, this is who I am, this is what I am about, and that's what this ritual is going to serve. So they are very, in the positive way, they're very egocentric rituals, very much based on the individual, his or her needs and sense of what is appropriate. They can cause family dissension with spouse, or the adult children of the older person. Like I said, these are somewhat controversial. They make a lot of people feel a bit at unease. They think a pre-funeral is macabre. Why are you going? Why are you using this funeral? Why are you using the motif of death in order to celebrate life? It's kind of ritually jarring to have everything look like a funeral, except that there's no dead person. Though the person at the center, everyone knows, and you know that, like everyone else, is that the person will die. But there's just something odd about that, like someone popping out of a coffin or something. That's not what you have here. But it's just an ill fit for a lot of people that make a lot of people uncomfortable. And it's considered just unnecessary. Look, when you die, you'll have your funeral, and that's going to be expensive anyway. So why do you want to have some additional cost on top of that? And it can also amplify already existing narrative of the elderly spouse or the parent as eccentric or cantankerous or something like that. Well, dad's just being dad. He's always, he was always kind of a crank, and we don't have to listen to him. He's just being cranky by asking for a pre-funeral. Still, the pre-funeral when they are performed, they can inscribe new meaning into the familiar cultural form of a funeral, and especially the funeral as a rite of passage that marks, again, so much of Japanese family life and public life. The pre-deceased, I guess that's the best way to call them, the pre-deceased controls the ritual, and that's really important. It all becomes on the person to control the ritual. Obviously, as the pre-deceased and not the dead, they're not a passive object under ritual control as with the deceased. Control by the predeceased, and as a rite of passage, and it is a rite of passage, the predeceased is an initiate, I guess we can use that term, is key in a pre-funeral, and the pre-funeral is a sort of, it is a rite of passage, and it's a new rite of passage that fits in, though still is controversial, into Japan's larger, dense ritual landscape. Initiate control also makes it unusual for a rite of passage, I think. And I just put a question, I didn't put a question mark there, but that may be a question. It seems like, most rites of passage, the initiate has little control. Maybe the ritual is traditional or something like that. Certainly in a funeral, the dead has absolutely no control. In birthing or birth celebration rituals, obviously the baby has little control. And weddings, probably a wedding is the area in which a person has most control. Though we do have a criticism of people, the notion of the bridezilla. A bridezilla is simply a woman who wants, on her own special day, wants really complete control. And so there is this sort of inherent criticism of taking too much control of the ritual. So it seems like to me many rites of passages, especially older rites of passages, they would seem to be built on less control by the initiate, the control being in the hands of ritual overseers or just in the process of the ritual itself. So in that way, the predeceased in a pre-funeral really stands apart at least your Japanese rites of passages. A sense of liminality betwixt and between of the initiated is also highlighted in pre-funeral. The pre-deceased, via the ritual, is publicly transitioning in life and also making a public statement in life that I've lived for 60 years or 77 years, I've lived a good life, and I've done everything that was expected of me. I lived as a good Japanese, putting myself, investing myself in my family, in my company, and things like that. I don't have many years left. That's also what this is marking. And I want to live in a different way. I want to live for myself. And so that's very important. And one way, you know, we can think about that is why the motif of a funeral? Why not the motif of a birthday party? And again, birthday parties are somewhat new themselves, and usually with a younger generation. But I think a birthday party just can't really mark the intensity of the transition that one is kind of, you know, dying to an old self and entering into a new stage of life with new hopes and expectations upon one. And part of those expectations are, to a certain extent, you know, I've lived for people. I thank you. I love you. But I want to live on my own, the way I want to live for myself in my last remaining years. And I think because of that sort of a death of an old self, a death of an older identity, I think at least that's one of the reasons why the motif of the funeral plays. And something like a birthday party would just be too shallow and couldn't really capture the intensity and the importance for the pre-deceased of the transition. And also, and part of that is also the impending death. I mean, you can't walk away from the fact that a lot of this is being done. The predeceased knows that they have far fewer years to live than they have lived. And again, a birthday party can't capture that. And really, the funeral motif captures it in a very powerful, intense way. So one of the most, and this kind of really brought the notion of pre-funerals into the public imagination with this actress, Mizunoe Takiko. Mizunoe would be the family name, and Takiko would be her given name. And I'm not so sure that may be something of a stage name too. She was an actress, and she was a noted actress in the here she is when she was much younger. Some of you may know about this. The Takata Zuka is a very famous all-female troupe in Japan, with stages in Nagoya, that's the original stage, and also in Tokyo, all female. They play all the roles. So there she is. I don't know. It looks like maybe the Artful Dodger or something like that. And it's really wonderful to go because you never know what you're going to see. I saw a performance of Jesus Christ Superstar a couple of years ago. Done by the Takata Zuka in Tokyo, they'll do their own interpretations of musicals. They'll take plays and make them into musicals. They have their own completely original productions. But she was quite famous, and she went to when her sister died. She had a traditional Buddhist funeral. Her sister was a very bubbly, over the top personality type, as Mizunoe Takiko was. And, you know, she's an actress, and so she goes and she sees this, you know, traditional Buddhist funeral, this kind of a cold black and white photo of the dead, flowers, the chanting of Buddhist sutras, and some friends going up there and saying nice things about the dead. But it left her cold, saying that this there's no way this funeral ever captured who my sister was in life, and that if anything, that's what a funeral should be. And so she said, I don't want any part of this. And so she was one of the first, at least a very public person who people knew, who had a pre-funeral. And there she is in 1993. That was her pre-funeral. Let's see, I think she was around 77 at that time. And there she is. And that would be her picture. So there's a black and white picture. That would have been a picture of her when she was much younger as an actress. But again, the black and white picture, and sometimes they're colored now, of course. But that's always part of a Buddhist funeral, of a Japanese funeral, and you can see the flowers there too. So it has all kind of, in terms of material culture, it has all the motifs of a funeral. But there she is as the predeceased in under her control, having people speak about her and clearly enjoying her time. And then in 2009, that's when she actually died. And that's her, the TV screen reporting her death. Here is the pre-funeral, 2008, of Takaoka Osamu. He's a famous poet, a haiku poet. And by the way, Paul, those were beautiful haiku. Those were wonderful selections. Especially the last one, struck me as being similar to something that he wrote here. So he's a literary critic, a literary scholar, and a poet. I was wondering if he was still alive, and he is still alive. But this was in 2008 when he would have been 60 years old. So that would have been, if you're going to do a pre-funeral, that would be usually the earliest time you would do it. And so there he is, right? He's on the left, and that is his son and his grandson. And here he is, and this is, you know, and then he's setting this up. Now, many pre-funerals do not have a cleric of any type. He wanted, this may be a friend of his, I'm not so sure, he wanted a Buddhist cleric. So he kind of liked that idea of giving it an even a more of a traditional aspect by having a Buddhist cleric there. And there he is. And then there's a funeral pyre, and as substitute for his body, there are, I think those look like sakaki leaves, which are the sacred leaves. You see them oftentimes in Shinto shrines as a wand or something like that. Meditating on death, as these sakaki leaves are now burning, so will he, and we'll all die, and he will die, but he will be, you know, cremated. And so looking upon that, you see a vision of your own future. Now you can make a lot of money as a scholar in Japan. So unlike this country, as a literary scholar. He's made this little park for himself. There, and this is where the pre-funeral was held. Here's this stone with his given name, that's Osamu. I'm not so sure why this side is blank. Maybe he wants to, that he still has some life to live. Maybe it will be filled in with something else when he dies. I'm not so sure. And here is his haiku on this small black stone. And this is my translation. I'm not a literary person, but I translate it as, "Surely we are all unfinished cherry blossoms twisted in our deaths." So just in the midst of life, like, you know, we all know the cherry blossoms in Japan, right? They're so beautiful, they're here, but then they're gone. Such is the way of life. And, you know, we never know when that wind will come up, twist us off, and take us with it. So there are some aspects of pre-funerals. Now I want to go to something else, and this is sudden death temples. This is not so much, again, sudden death temples are not that new. They've been around for quite a while, but there has been an explosion of them in the last 30 years or so. And when I say sudden death temples, I don't mean a Buddhist temple that is there primarily for the notion of sudden death, but Buddhist temples in Japan offer a variety of services. And like hotels, because Buddhism, generally speaking, the rituals of life, especially early life, birth and things like that, and marriage are dominated in a Shinto idiom, and the rituals at the end of life death, funerals, ancestorhood, those are dominated in Buddhist idioms. So the Buddhism is always, it has its feelers out there kind of on the pulse of the culture. And it's always coming up with new ways to invest itself into new rituals or new expressions of concerns about aging and death and dying. And that's what the sudden death temples are about. And in Japanese, it would be called Pokuri Dera. Dera just means temple. Pokuri, some of you may know, I don't know, but Japanese is really rich in onomatopoeia. And so Pokuri is the sound of something ending suddenly. And here the sudden death temple is you go to a sudden death temple not to pray for your life to end tomorrow. That's not what it means. You go to the sudden death temple, you want to live as long as possible, a healthy life where you're vibrant. And then once you start that decline, that's when you want to go. That's where the suddenness comes from. You don't want this slow decline that's going to cost your family time and money. You know, it's a very common scene with the aging of Japan and so many houses today of a small hospital-like bed, and there's a parent there, you know, with well into the hundreds, and the daughter, or likely the daughter-in-law, is taking care of the person. The person struggles to speak and things like that. That's what you want to avoid. So the suddenness is, I don't want to die, I want to die tomorrow. That's not what it is. The suddenness is, I want to live a long time, but once my vibrancy and energy starts to go, that's it. Let me die at that point. So that's where you go to the Buddhist temples in order to seek the blessings of the Buddhas to achieve that. Buddhist temples in Japan are very much noted, also Shinto shrines. A lot of religion in Japan is very much noted for what some scholars call worldly benefits. You're always seeking some sort of health, happiness, ease in this world. That's why you go to visit the Shinto shrine. That's why you go to visit the Buddhist temple. People don't meditate really at a Buddhist temple. They go and they engage the variety of rituals and the powers of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas to bring you know, happiness and joy into their lives. That's the main purpose. And so here we have some pilgrims heading to a temple known as Anichi-ji. Ji just means that's another way of saying temple. So when you hear something ji in Japanese, that's just the temple. And this is in the ancient capital of Nara, and they that are offering pokuri, sudden death services, are all over the country. But many of them historically were concentrated in this ancient cultural area around Nara, Kyoto, and that area. And here we have pilgrims coming from, I don't know where they're coming from, but obviously, you know, two things stand out. They're not spring chickens anymore. They are old, but they're very active. I mean, they're smiling, they're healthy. This is what they want. And this is what they want to last, to continue as long as possible. But when that starts to decline, that's when it's time to go. And so they're getting off the train station there in the ancient city of Nara to visit this temple. Again, these temples are the temples are not exclusively sudden death. That sounds kind of dramatic. It's just a Buddhist temple that offers various rituals and services for that need and that concern. But this is a famous one. So there's a signpost. And right there, and there's a bicycle right there, so that's a large sign, and it is clear, that says in Japanese, that says Pokuri Dera. So it's saying sudden death temple this way. There's a sign, an arrow there. And then here is the entrance. It's a rather humble temple. It's of the Pure Land School, which is one of the many different schools of Buddhism in Japan. It's a fairly culturally dominant one, the Pure Land School. Now, in this temple itself, Anichiji, because it is a Pure Land temple, in the middle there is the main Buddha of Pure Land, who is Amitabha, in the Sanskrit, better known in Japanese as Amida. Pure Land theology is very death-centric historically. It's based upon living a life of faith in the power of Amitabha or Amida, to at the point of where you die, Amitabha will come down and will pick you up and take you to his Pure Land in a distant western quadrant of the cosmos. But there, also here, enshrined, and this is very common in Japanese Buddhist temples, is a monk, a very, very famous monk. His name was Genshin. What are the years? 942 to 1017. He's very famous for writing a work that was very culturally significant, where he wrote about the joys of the Pure Land, and he also wrote about all the sorts of hells. Buddhism is quite noted for its hells, all sorts of hells: freezing hells, burning hells, hells where you have to eat your own fecal matter and things like that, and all sorts of horrible demons who force you to do things you don't want to do. And he was right, he wrote very powerfully about these hells, and also along with the joys of the Pure Land, as a way to encourage Pure Land faith. And his descriptions of hells were very, very frightening. No one had any really idea. The notion of a hell was not in pre-Buddhist Japanese culture. There was a sort of an underworld or something like that, but a place where you would go and be forced to go and just suffer horrific punishments, that was kind of new on the Japanese landscape. And he was the first one to write very vividly about it and really frighten people into having the faith of Amitabha. But beyond that very important piece of work he wrote, as time went by, his different memories of him were developed within Buddhism. And most Buddhist temples in Japan, they will have some sort of foundational story, or engi, as they're known in Japanese. And these are a mix of history and legend and myth. And it basically is a way of saying, at this spot where this Buddhist temple is, something really profound and important happened. And it tries to tie its rituals to this foundational story, to say that its rituals can be very efficacious because of what happened before. And so part of the engi, or the foundational story of Anichiji here, is that Genshin was close. He was born very close. So this is his home area. That he also carved, he made, and this is, well, I don't know, I don't, I shouldn't call it legendary, I have no idea, but there's always a strong mix of legend in these foundational stories, but that he carved this statue of Amitabha or Amida as a way of mourning his mother when his mother died. He also had some white kind of an underwear kimono blessed by Amitabha, and he gave that to his mother. He wrapped that he wrapped his dying mother in that, and she was able to experience a very easy, painless death because of that kimono that was blessed by Amitabha. He himself experienced a painless death. He was one of the original members. There's a very famous Buddhist center called Mount Hiei, just northwest or so of Kyoto. It's of the Tendai school, very, very important school. But it was in the Tendai school, that's where a lot of faith in Amitabha developed. And he was one of the founding members of this group of 25 monks who essentially created a worship group exclusively around Amitabha. It also functioned as a sort of a hospice. They made, as a part of the membership into this group, all the 25 members vowed to help each one as he eventually would lay dying, to make sure that all the rituals were in place and that his faith was secured in order to go to the Pure Land. And it was really considered. There was a sense of an ideal death, and the ideal death is that you chanted faith in Amitabha to take you to the Pure Land right at the last moment. Your very last words were, "I put my trust in Amitabha. I put my trust in Amitabha." Obviously, people die of cancer and things like that. They go and they become unconscious. They start to have, hallucinations and things like that. They lose control of their bowels. And the members were there to whisper encouragement in the dying person's ear, to clean up any fecal matter or vomit, to try to keep the area as clean as possible, as a welcoming spot for Amitabha to descend with his bodhisattvas to take the dead away. And so he was one of these founding members, and that this, as the story goes, he himself died very, very peacefully and easily. So because of all of that sort of, that plays into the foundational story, this is considered a very, among many choices that any older person has, this is considered a very, very, a temple that's very, very efficacious in helping people meet their future goal of a pukuri death. Of a sudden, easy death. Another thing which is very common in Japanese religion, both in Shinto and in Buddhism, is amulets. You see them for sale everywhere in shrines, in Shinto shrines and Buddhist temples. And the whole idea of an amulet is that you take that the power that is located there in the temple with the Buddha or the Bodhisattva or the famed figure who's also enshrined there, and you have that empowered in the amulet itself, and therefore you can take that home with you, and the power of the temple, the power of the Buddha, goes home with you in compact form. Here is a small amulet that would probably only be about maybe 3 inches or so, I think. And it is requesting, asking for protection against senility. That's there, bokeh. And that would be, that's a common word in Japan, in Japanese, for senility, and also for paralysis. So those are the things you don't want to have. You want to live as long as you can, but you don't want to keep on living and entering into a state of paralysis where you're bedridden, into a state where you're senile. You want death to happen before that comes about. What do we have next? This is a paper amulet. There is Avalokiteshvara. Very famous bodhisattva of deep, deep compassion and mercy, known in Japanese as Kanon. And again, it is requesting a long life, no senility, and a quick and peaceful death. And this is what you get. This is from another sudden death temple. And here at another sudden death temple, I wouldn't say it's close to where I live, but maybe about an hour from where I spend my time when I go to Japan. And this is underwear that you can buy. And again, this is not the same temple that we looked at before, but that whole kind of foundational gesture, that foundational action that Genshin took with his mother to wrap her in a kimono that had been blessed by Amitabha, that led her to a very peaceful death. That is kind of what's getting across here, that this underwear has been blessed, and so it's no ordinary underwear. And this is to help you, give you that little kind of spiritual, energy or something like that, to help you control your bowels and things. And I would say that this is just to finish things here. You do have In Japan, there is kind of an inside baseball discussion within, among some Buddhist and Buddhist intellectuals about really how Buddhist is Japanese Buddhism. It's a very small conversation, but you do have it. that maybe Japanese Buddhism has moved too far away from Indian roots or something like that. I have no investment in these sorts of discussions, and I personally find them rather, as a total outsider, I find them rather silly. They seem to be built on the assumption of really past mindfulness and a certain suspicion of change. Yeah, and Japanese Buddhism is very, very different from what we think we know of earliest Indian Buddhism. But in its own way, pre-funerals and definitely sudden death temples, there's something very Buddhist about them. If you read the early Buddhist writings that probably came about or so, I don't know, 200-300 years or so after the death of Siddhartha, the focus on death is just so intense. Again, according, you know, the foundational story of Siddhartha is that one, the thing that got him to finally leave the palace and that sort of bubble life he was leading and to strike out on his own and to seek enlightenment was the scene where he saw an old man, a sick man, and a dead man. And that notion of that one needs to be mindful of one's death at all times, you see it in so many ways in the ancient literature, from meditating, looking at decomposing bodies and meditating on it, to all sorts of things. And you see, this is something that we read with my students in my introductory course. It's a wonderful little story from the Pali Canon called The Weaver's Daughter, where a young girl, she really wants to meet Siddhartha, and he comes to her town, and he talks, and he says this, practice reflection on death, thinking life is unsure, death is sure. And so she takes that to heart, and she reflects on her own death for 3 years, and after 3 years, Siddhartha comes back, and she's all happy to see him, and he has an interview with her in front of all the townspeople, and he congratulates her on the depth of her mind that she has meditated on death, and if something were to happen to her even today, she has a wonderful rebirth ahead of her. She's really ahead of the spiritual curve, unlike all the townspeople who don't really understand this conversation that Siddhartha is having with this young woman. And it's kind of it's a rather shocking ending. You have to read it. You have to read it a second time to see all the foreshadowing going on. But she goes home just at that just after she talks to Siddhartha, and a freak accident happens, and she dies. But her future life had been secured because she had meditated and practiced upon death and dying, and that's what these rituals are about. They're very old-fashioned in that sense, that we're all going to die, and that we can't wish it away, we can't deny, we can try to wish it away, we can try to deny it away, but when death comes, it will be a very, very unhappy death, and that by accepting death, embracing it, that when it does come, as it must come for all of us, we'll have a better death than if we try to deny it. So despite the fact that some scholars like to say that Japanese Buddhism has gotten too far away from its original roots, I can't think of anything actually more Buddhist and more traditionally Buddhist going on right now in Japan than these rituals. And that's it. Thank you very much.
And that concludes our forum. You've been listening to Professor William Lindsay speaking on new rituals and death and dying in contemporary Japan, recorded on May 22nd at the Lawrence Unitarian Fellowship. As we still have some time in our hour, stay tuned for some special programming after these messages.